Some of you really like this sort of thing, and some of you really don't. I was mentioning this earlier to some people. In sermons, you want sometimes to hear Christian living, how do I be a better person, etc., rather than a travelogue. I'm not, what's the guy's name, Steve? Who writes the books on travel? Everybody's afraid to say it. You know who I'm talking about? Anyway, there's a guy that writes travel books. I had it last Sabbath. I can't think of it now. But anyway, I don't want that to turn into this. But I want to show pictures from our trip because it, to me, this is the fifth time I've been there. This is the first time for our daughter, Emily. And it was interesting, the perspective of what she saw. It seemed like every time we turned a corner, it was, oh, wow, because it brings to life something that if you can't see it in person, you don't see the context or the perspective of it. So what I want to try and do is perhaps make some of the stories in the Bible come alive today through visual imagery, and not only to discuss some of the things that we saw, but how they fit in to the life and times of Jesus Christ and his ministry. Many of you in this life will never have the chance to visit Israel. So this may be your one and only option or opportunity, perhaps to see some things that are over there. And again, what I hope it does is it puts a place to a scripture rather than just words that you read on a page. For instance, when it says that they went up to Jerusalem or down to the Sea of Galilee, that does not mean north and south. That means up and down. If you go in Israel, it is hilly. And there are very few flat places in Israel, except the Jezreel Valley, which I'll show you some pictures of in a while and why that's important. But when we go through this today, I hope that I can kind of weave a story thread through this to perhaps make more sense. You know, the story of the ministry of Jesus Christ doesn't start in Jerusalem. And it doesn't end there either. Now, we often think of Jerusalem, you know, he goes to the synagogue and he overthrows the money changers and a lot of things happen, the trial, the crucifixion and all that occurs in Jerusalem. But that isn't where it starts and that isn't where it ends. So what I want to do today is show you where it started and kind of go through the early days of what Jesus Christ had to go through. And then we will get hopefully in context of what this will mean for us as we go forward, as well as for the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. Now, we'll start here with what is happening in Luke chapter 4. And for the first part of this, I'm going to be reading a lot from the book of Luke. Luke chapter 4 starts in verse 1 with the temptation of Jesus Christ. Chapter 3 of Luke talks about him going to the Jordan River and getting baptized. So his ministry is just about to start. So the whole water to wine in the wedding at Cana, that happened earlier. Remember, Christ's mom asked him to do this, and he said, why are you having me do this? It's not time yet, and my ministry hasn't started, in essence. But now it's going to start in earnest. He goes and get baptized. The very first thing that happens after his baptism is Satan tries to derail the whole plan of God. And you're going to see through this that there's a lot of things that Satan does at first to try and derail the ministry of Jesus Christ. So starting in verse 13, now when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time. Now we're going to see the opportune time occurs over and over and over again, especially at the start. Verse 14, then Jesus returned in the power, meaning the power of the Spirit. He now has, he's been baptized. It's time for his 3.5 year ministry to start. And where does he go? He returns in the power of the Spirit to Galilee. Now where is Galilee? Some people would look at it and say, well, it's a sea. Other people might say, well, it's a city. It's neither. It is a region, and if you look at the map, you can see that Galilee is up in the north. There is a central region that's called Samaria, a southern region called Judea. Up in Galilee, you're going to see things like Chorazin, Capernaum, Magdala. Mary Magdalene is, that means Mary from the town of Magdala. Tiberias, a lot of stuff has happened in Tiberias. You see Cana and Nazareth right next door to each other. They're less than 4 miles apart. We'll talk about that as we go. So Jesus, after getting baptized, he returns to Galilee. Now let's see what he does when he gets there. And news of him went throughout all the surrounding region. Again, Galilee is a region. It would be as if we were saying, Mr. Franks decided to visit the Deep South, right? That's not a city. That means he's going to go through Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama and Florida. And so it's a region. And news of him went out throughout all the region, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. So as we look at this, we recognize the fact that Jesus Christ now is in a situation where he is ready to start his ministry. And at first, he goes into the region of Galilee, and he actually is going to stay here for quite a bit of the first part of his ministry. He doesn't go down to Jerusalem for quite a while. Again, notice where some of these places are. Cana, or Cana, is where the water was changed to wine. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Let's go forward here in verse 16. It says, and then he came to Nazareth, where he was brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. Now, what happens from here on down for the rest of the chapter, you all know the story. But I don't know if you've ever put it in context of where this happened. So we're going to start from the beginning here. It says he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. This is the town that his parents had gone to. Remember, they went down to Egypt, and then when they returned from Egypt, they settled in Nazareth. So this is the place where he was. And it says, as his custom was, he went up to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. If you're not catching the context, you might think that what that means is that his custom was to go into the synagogue and read. And that's not what it's saying. It's saying his custom was to go to this synagogue on the Sabbath. But this time is different. He stood up to read. This is where he grew up. As a kid, he would not have gotten up and spoken. He would have listened to the rabbis or to the elders that were in the area. So he is in Nazareth, where he's brought up. And as his custom was, he went into this synagogue at age 30-something, when it's time to do his ministry. He's now starting the ministry, and he gets up to read. This is new, and you're going to see how this affected the people in just a moment. Now, where was this village? I'll show you some pictures here as we go through this. It's a very small little village that's in the area. In fact, so small, I wanted to show you something that is a humorous thing in the Bible that you probably don't recognize. Nathanael, who was one of the 12 apostles, was from Cana, and Jesus Christ was from Nazareth. They're 4 miles apart. So let's read this. This is in John 1, starting in verse 45. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael said, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" These are competing towns. It would be as if I would stand up here one of these days and say, "Brethren, I'm retiring, and your new pastor is from Tuscaloosa." Right? How many of you would say, "Well, can anything good come from Tuscaloosa?" Right? These are like competing villages. And Nathanael's like, "The Messiah was from Nazareth? Of all places." Very tiny little area. And something that I think most people would say, "No, this can't be." You know, you look back at the prophets, you don't see anything about this. So how could it possibly be from Nazareth? This is a picture of modern day Nazareth. Our daughter and I spent the first night here. It is a sprawling city now of 77,000 people. But as happens with a lot of olden places, the new city gets built on top of the old city, and so ruins get buried. When we went to Turkey for the Feast of Tabernacles in 2003, I mean, it was way back there. It may have been later than that. But we went to the seven church areas, so Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, went all the way through. Got to Philadelphia, which I was obviously really excited about. And the new city is built on top of the old ruins, and the only thing they had was a park about the size of this room. And that everything else is still buried. It's down there. They just haven't decided to dig. So there's not much there, but there is one thing that they found, and I'll show you this picture. This was found under a, I don't want to call it a monastery, but it probably is. It's a Byzantine church that's in central Nazareth. And this is an example of what a first century home would have looked like. And this was hewn out of solid rock. There are rooms So immediately when they found this, the guy that found it says, I found Jesus' home. No, this isn't Jesus' home. This is just an example of a house that would have been from that period of time. But that's the city of Nazareth. Not a lot more is known about the region, again, from antiquity, because the new city is built right over the top of the old city. Well, let's go back again now, and let's read this in its entirety now, and then you'll see what it is that where the story can lead us. So back in Luke chapter 4, starting in verse 16. So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he stood up on the Sabbath. He went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. So here's what he read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord was upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor." Now, get what he's saying here. He's in his home church area where they saw him grow up as a kid, and he's now going to read from the book of Isaiah about himself. Now, imagine how you would take that. I don't have a good example here, but what if Brendan all of a sudden would come up here and say, "Folks, God has revealed to me that I am the Elijah to come, and I'm going to go back in the Old Testament and I'm going to read about it." You would probably start throwing tomatoes at him. And you're going to see that that's very similar to what happened here. No offense to Brendan, of course. And he was handed the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. And he has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind. And he set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And he closed the book, and he gave it back to the attendant, and he sat down. And the eyes of all who were in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." He was announcing to his home church, "The start of my 3.5-year ministry has begun. I am the Messiah. I came from God. I go back to God. This is the start of it." And he did it in his home church. Now, there's a reason why, as an example, Mr. Horchek would never send me to pastor in Lafayette, Indiana, because that's where I grew up as a snot-nosed little kid who got in trouble every Sabbath when I was 9 years old, and I did. Some of you would look back at that and think, "No, surely not." Yeah, surely yes. I was young and I was a teenager, and I got in all kinds of trouble as I was a kid. I remember going back to the, I think it was the fourth, it might have been the 30th or 40th anniversary of the Lafayette Church. And because I was in telecommunications, I hooked up to where former pastors could talk. And we had one of our former pastors got on the line, and I said, "Okay, you're on the line, go ahead and talk." And the very first thing he says, "Is this Phil? You know, little Philly?" That's almost what he said. There just would be no respect for me back there, so that's not where we get sent. But he's doing this in his home church area. So how did the people take this? I think you'll find this is very interesting here as he announces he's the Messiah. Let's drop down to verse 22. "So all bore witness of him, and they marveled at his gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth, but they said, 'Isn't this Joseph's son?'" So he's speaking as if he has authority. He wasn't taught at the feet of Gamaliel. He didn't go to some theological institution and get his master's or PhD. He disappeared for a few months. He went out in the wilderness, and when he came back, all of a sudden, he's the Messiah. So then, verse 24, Jesus Christ says, "Assuredly, I say unto you, a prophet is not accepted in his own country." He recognized the fact that he wasn't going to get a lot done here, because they had witnessed him from the time that he was a baby, or not a baby, 3, 4, 5 years old, however old he was when he came back from Egypt. And so what we see here is, at the very first, there is a problem. Now, remember I said that Satan was dogging him all along the way? This story you will recognize, but I don't know that you recognized where it was happening and why. So let's keep reading. Down in verse 28. "So everyone in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with rage. And they rose up and they thrust him out of the city, and they led him to the brow of a hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down over the cliff. And passing through the midst of them, he went his way." We've read that before, that Jesus Christ had to escape being stoned to death or thrown over a cliff. This happened on the very first day of the start of his ministry in Nazareth from his hometown people. Satan is going to dog him all along the way. You're going to see this as he starts his ministry, let alone the Sadducees and the Pharisees that dogged him. He's going to be experiencing trouble all along the way. So here he is. He escapes with his life as he kind of disappears through the crowd. So obviously not a lot of growth occurred in Nazareth, the village that knew him as a child. So where does he go from here? Verse 31. Then he went down to Capernaum. Capernaum is that little red dot on the map. Capernaum is a town that's right on the edge of the Sea of Galilee. There are all kinds of names for this body of water, by the way. Sea of Galilee, which it's not. It's a lake. Lake Tiberias, because Tiberias is one of the towns. Lake Gennesaret, because of a city that's named close to that. But a lot of the cities that dotted this outline sometimes would refer to this lake from the name of their city. But we see that Jesus Christ went from Nazareth and he went down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and he was teaching to them in their synagogues. And they were astonished at his teaching, for his word was with authority. So now he's not in his hometown anymore, and now people are starting to listen. Isn't it interesting how he had no effect, as it were, in Nazareth? But notice one of the very first things that happens as he enters this synagogue, which we'll look at in just a minute. Now, in the synagogue, there was a man who had the spirit of an unclean demon, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Let us alone. What have we have to do with you, Jesus Nazareth? Did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." So Satan tries to derail him through a temptation. Then he tries to derail him by having him thrown off a cliff. He leaves there and goes to Capernaum, and now he's being dogged by people with unclean spirits. Now, the unclean spirit did identify him as the Messiah, which I always find interesting. I would have thought that Satan would have wanted to keep that quiet, but it got blurted out anyway. So here we are in this small little area on the Sea of Galilee. Again, this is a village. Now, what I want to show you is some very interesting things, and I hope that if you've not seen this before, you'll find this kind of exciting. He says that he went into the synagogue of Capernaum to pray, and this was where he met this man with an unclean spirit. This is that actual synagogue where he spoke. If you see here it is. If you see down here at the bottom, the black stones, that is from the synagogue that was in Capernaum at the time of Jesus Christ. This is the synagogue that he preached at when the guy with the unclean spirit challenged him. Now, what's built on top of it, these white stones, is from the 4th century. So after the 1st century church or synagogue was destroyed, the Byzantines came back and built a kind of Christian-type church on top of that. Recognizing the fact that this was that very synagogue, they built another church on top of that to try and honor, as it were, the spot. So we were able to walk around here and look at this. There are a lot of things here that are very interesting. The structure on top of it is a 4th century structure. And then surrounding this are a lot of homes. So here is now the 4th century church that's on top of it. And as you go through and you look at this, this whole area is surrounded by the... So this would have had beams and a ceiling and all that. The beams and ceiling were made out of wood and plaster, and that over time has rotted. So all that's left is some of the concrete there. By the way, you probably have seen the earthquake that happened in Turkey and Syria. That was felt as far down as the center of Israel. So a lot of these churches that were built in the 1st to 4th century, a lot of them got destroyed by earthquakes. And we did a lot of touring in Turkey and in Jordan, and you can find a lot of ancient ruins where all of the columns are laying in the same direction because when the earth shifted, they all landed in one way. So this is that very area. And then surrounding that are the buildings that would represent the houses. So in a little village like this, very similar to Middle America, the center of town is the church. You think back to Little House on the Prairie. You remember the TV series where the church was also the school, was also the place for public meetings, and it was in the center of town. And then you had people that lived around that. These are the foundation stones of all of the buildings that would have surrounded the synagogue, and the synagogue would have been right in the center. These structures that you see here are houses from that area. Now, I want to go just a little bit further down and show you something, and I'll give you an overhead shot here in a couple of slides that'll make more sense. Right outside of the synagogue, as you walk toward the Sea of Galilee, and you'll see this in a picture in just a minute, is a larger stone structure that doesn't fit with anything else. It looks different than everything else. So, Luke 4, verse 38, he arose from the synagogue and entered Simon Peter's house. So he leaves the synagogue and goes immediately to Simon Peter's house. But Simon's wife's mother was sick with a high fever, and they made request of him concerning her. So he stood over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her. And immediately she arose and served him. Now, it's going to be a little hard to see here, but again, the buildings around this area, something looks very different from the rest of it. And we'll explain why in just a moment. If you look at the... and I've got a better picture of this in a minute. But there is an ancient structure, which is this right here. And then on top of it is another structure that was built later. And then on top of that is a modern-day Catholic church. So it's a little hard to see, but I want to try and show you. Here's a video of this right here. And if you look in there, you can see some of this that's still existing. And again, I'll have a better picture of this in just a moment. So this is an octagonal structure that is built over the ruins of a house. And then what you see on the top of that is the bottom of the Catholic Church. So these are first century ruins that are built on top of a house. There's mosaic tile. Mosaic tile is everywhere in this region. They didn't have ceramic tile floors or rugs or wood. They used mosaics, and a lot of these houses were like that. So let me describe what you're seeing here, and then we'll go to the next slide. There are the structure that you see is actually a first century building that was built on top of it, and we'll explain what that octagonal thing is in just a moment. But there was a house underneath. And then there was this octagonal structure, and then later on something added to the top of that. The ancient theory was that this was the house that Peter lived in. In other words, Christ came out of the synagogue and went right into Peter's house. There is a very good chance that this actually is the house of Peter, and here's why. The structure that was built on top of it was built in the first century. Now, if you know anything about the way the first century, I don't mean 100 to 200. I mean 0 to 99. So Peter, wherever he lived, by the time Peter had died and within a decade or so after he died, the people of the region recognized the importance of this house, and they built this octagonal structure over the top of it. So this would still be within the memory of when Peter and his wife and his mother-in-law lived there. This structure over the top is, this picture on the left was there before they built the Catholic Church over the top of it. And you can see the octagonal nature of it. And you see this round part here, that's this round part here. If you look at the blue, that was the existing house, and then some of the really light gray, that was the existing house that people think, and I think it's a pretty good chance was Peter's house. The light blue or gray, depending upon what it looks like on your screen, that was a building that was built over the top of that of what tradition would have said was Peter's house. Now, here's the description of that. You can see it at the bottom. An octagonal Byzantine martyrium. A martyrium was a building that was built to honor a place where an important person lived. Okay, a martyrium structure was built in the first century CE, so sometime in the 80s or 90s probably, on the purported site of St. Peter's house. According to the excavators, the central hall of the church was originally built as a part of a residential structure about the beginning of the early Roman period, around 63 BCE. So the house was built 50, 60 years before Christ would have been born. So this house, by the time Peter got it, would have been 100 or so years old, and this is a very good chance that this was where he was. Although it is not mentioned specifically where in Capernaum Jesus stayed, The fair inference seems to be that he lived at Peter's house, which was fairly close to the synagogue. So you've got the synagogue, you've got a house that was built and occupied during the time of Christ, and just after Peter would have died, this property is made into a martyrium. So the people of that area recognized the solemnity of this place. Very good possibility that it is a part of, would have been where Peter lived. Also, right next to this is the Sea of Galilee. And we'll show you pictures there. So you've got the synagogue. You've got, well, I guess it's this way, the synagogue. You've got what probably was Peter's house. And then you've got the Sea of Galilee right here. What was Peter's profession? He was a fisherman. And he owned boats. We'll see that in the next scripture then. So if he owned boats and he lived right by the sea, there's a very good chance that that, again, was his house. Let's keep going here. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Luke chapter 5, so this is right after he's healed Peter's mother-in-law. And so it was, as the multitude pressed about him to hear the word of God. So where is he? He's at Peter's place. That he stood by the lake of Gennesaret. This is the Sea of Galilee, this lake. And he saw two boats standing by the lake. So he's at Peter's place. This is right after chapter 4. The people start to press him, and he realizes they're not going to hear me if I'm just standing around. I mean, if I have a crowd of people around me and I'm talking this way, anybody behind me isn't going to hear me. So what's he going to do? He's by the lake anyway. He saw two boats stand by the lake, but the fishermen had gone from them and were washing their nets. Then he got into one of the boats, which belonged to Simon Peter. Again, this was probably next to his house. And he asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and he taught the multitudes from the boat. Anybody that's ever seen this, my brother and I used to do this when we were kids. He'd get in one boat and row to one end of a lake, and I'd go to row to the other, and we could talk to each other in this this volume and hear each other crystal clear because it's just a natural amplifier. So he recognized the fact, if all of these people are going to hear me, then we need to make it a little easier for them. So he gets in one of Peter's boats, and he goes out, turns around, and then he can just talk in a natural voice. And there is a, I didn't get a picture of it, but right to this area is kind of a natural amphitheater that's right down by the water where all these people could have sat and listened to Jesus Christ as he was speaking on the boat. This is a video of that area. The rocks that you see are the rocks that I fell on, so I have a mixed emotion about this next video. This, again, was on the very first day. This is the first thing that we did is we went to the synagogue, Peter's house, fall on the rocks. So here is the Sea of Galilee. Imagine, if you will, as you're seeing this, this is the lake where Jesus Christ walked on water and where Peter did for a few seconds. This is where Jesus Christ was asleep in the bottom of the boat, and this storm came up. I'll tell you a story about that. The first time I went there, we were on a boat on the Sea of Galilee, and we were having a Bible study. There were 25 or 30 of us. And we're reading, and all of a sudden, the captain of the boat said, "Close your books, close your Bibles right now." And some of us did, some of us didn't. I closed mine. And all of a sudden, this storm hit us out of nowhere. And some people who didn't close their Bible actually had pages ripped out of their Bible. The storm was so strong. He could see it from where he was. If you've ever been in a boat and you can look out at the still water and then see the roiling and it gets closer and closer and closer to you, from up on top of the boat, he could see that. But storms can happen just like that there. While we were there, it was very, very clear, which is really neat to see. But anyway, here's just a little video clip from the Sea of Galilee. And those nasty rocks. And in the lower right-hand corner is my daughter's forearm. I actually stopped this. I went all the way through to her smiling face, and I thought, no one, I don't need to be showing pictures of my family. So I stopped it right there. But anyway, that's the Sea of Galilee. So this is where he started. After leaving Nazareth, he went to Galilee. Galilee is where he got all of his disciples. It even says that later on. It says when he was by the fire and the lady said, "You were with him," your speech betrays you because you're Galileans. They all came from this region. There actually are a lot of people that think that most of the disciples that Jesus Christ conscripted to help him were related to him in some way, maybe a second or third cousin or whatever, that a lot of them, we know that there were brothers anyway, but some of the brothers were probably first cousins to others and then somehow perhaps also related to Jesus Christ. So a lot of the people that he got, in fact, all of the people that he got are from this area. All right, then from there, what does it say he did? And seeing the multitude, so after he was done, he went up on a high mountain, or on a mountain, and when he was seated to his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, and this is where he talks about the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, you know, blessed is that kind. So now we're going up to the Mount of Beatitudes. Now here, I want us to understand something. I recognize I'm 64, but even our car had trouble getting up this hill. Why in the world would Jesus Christ say, hey, let's go vertically climb straight up for a mile and a half, and I'll finish preaching up there? I have no idea. Maybe it was to weed out the weak. I don't know. But this is way up there. And you'll see in just a little while from the traditional spot of where he preached and looking down at where we were, these people were in really good shape. It reminds me of the one, I'm digressing, I'm sorry, I'm making a long sermon longer. Remember the Apostle Paul, they said, hey, you know, we're heading back to Jerusalem, let's get in a boat. And he's like, no, I'll walk. Why? Right? There were no taxis, there were no cars, they just walked everywhere. So these people were in great shape. So let's go up to the top and let's look back down. So this is right off to the left, which you can't see, is a Franciscan monastery called the Mount of Beatitudes or whatever. And again, this is the traditional spot where Jesus Christ would have taught. Whether or not this is the exact spot, we don't know, but this is the mountain. This is the hill that he was on. And in the background there, you can see where we were. So this is Galilee, the Sea of Galilee, and the ruins are right down in this spot right here. This is several miles away and straight uphill. I mean, to get there, the car, we're doing switchbacks. You know what a switchback is, if you've ever, it took, and the car groaned and grumbled the whole way there with just two of us in it. No comments about how heavy I am. So again, traditional site. All right, so we're going to leave here, and we're going to go up to a place called Megiddo. Now, I did not take this picture. This was from a drone, but I wanted to show you on the map where this is and why this area is important. So we started out in Nazareth. We went up to the Sea of Galilee and to Capernaum. We actually went down to Tiberias, where there's an ancient boat that they found in 1968. There was a drought, and so they went out to do some archaeological digging while the water had receded from the shoreline. And they dug in the mud, and they found a boat that had been buried and preserved there, and they built a whole museum around the boat. Carbon dated from the time of Christ, and it would have given you an idea of what a boat from that era would have looked like. I don't have that in here. One of these days, if you want to go through some of these, we can have a Bible study and I'll just go through all these slides. But anyway, this is called Tel Megiddo. Tel simply means a hill. A tel, again, is not a hill like we would think of a hill. A tel is where a city used to be that's now been covered in dirt. So Tel Megiddo, this is a place where there was a village at one time. All right, so Tel Megiddo. If we look in Judges chapter 1 and verse 27, this is one of the cities that it says Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. So this is one of the towns. Jerusalem was one. If you remember me talking about David, the city of David, Jerusalem was one of those cities that they couldn't completely defeat, and Megiddo was one of them as well. So this is a very common in this day and age. You put a city on top of a hill, and then you put fortifications around it to try and keep people from sieging and taking it over. So this is Megiddo. What is important about Megiddo? Show of hands. Who knows why Megiddo is important in Bible prophecy? No, not very many. Okay. Let's go a little further. This is actually the ruins, and the next couple of pictures you're going to see after we read something in the book of Revelation, you're going to see I'm going to be up on this spot here, and I'm going to be taking a video. So let's read what it is that's important about this area. Revelation chapter 16, starting in verse 12. Then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and the water was dried up so that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are spirits of demons performing signs, which go out before the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them together to the great battle of that great day of Almighty God. All of these hundreds of millions of people are going to come and gather in a place and then march down to Jerusalem to try and defeat the returning Christ. Verse 15, behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And they gathered them together to the place in the Hebrew called Armageddon. Armageddon is Hebrew for Har Megiddo, the hill of Megiddo. So these armies that are going to challenge Jesus Christ at his return are going to gather in the valley that's just below Har Megiddo or Armageddon. Now, I've always wondered at this. This prophecy is obviously in the Bible. The river Euphrates is going to dry up. There are going to be three kings. They're going to be doing miracles. They're going to gather 200 men. Surely someone's going to look at this and say, should I be here? But somehow Satan is going to blind them to the place. So they're going to gather in this valley, which is one of the few flat places in this area. That's where the armies are going to gather. And then they're going to march down to Jerusalem, which is about 50 miles away, to try and fight the returning Jesus Christ. So this gives you an idea graphically. This is Tel Megiddo is up on a hill, but then right below it is the Jezreel Valley, and then you keep coming down to the Jordan Valley, and you march all the way down to Jerusalem. So this is where the armies of the world are going to gather, just below Tel Megiddo. All right, here is a video of that area. Again, I'm standing at the very top, and I'm going to sweep from left to right so that you can see this yawning valley. There's dozens and dozens of miles of just flat area. And right now, it's beautiful. It's vineyards and olive groves and all of this. So this will give you an idea of, this is the Jezreel Valley taken from Tel Megiddo. Can you see an earth that had been destroyed through the tribulation and the day of the Lord, and having all these armies gather down here? And in the distance, you see those hills. If you were to go left and then down, you would go down to the Jordan Valley, and then all the way down, and then in those hills in the distance is Jerusalem, where they will fight the returning Christ. All right, let's go on now to Jerusalem. I want to talk a little bit about this. I have covered the Temple Mount and other sermons. See how I'm doing on time. Okay, I'm okay so far. Good. I've covered the Temple Mount in other sermons, so I won't repeat that now. But I did go out. I've done this, Josh, a couple times. I've gone out to try and find that sermon, and it's just not there. So at some point in time, I may redo that on why we believe that where the Dome of the Rock is where where Solomon's temple was. There's some pretty good architectural evidence of that. And I've done that before. I did it when I first came here almost 10 years ago. But I wanted to show you a few pictures of the Temple Mount, of the Garden of Gethsemane, and give you an idea of what that area looks like. Again, for those that have never been there, you will see something that perhaps you've never seen. This is, I always find this cute. This sign has changed. I've been there 5 times, and it keeps changing, but it always says the same thing. According to Torah law, now Torah law does not mean Genesis through Leviticus. This means according to the rabbis and the Mishnah and the Talmud and all that. According to Torah law, entering the Temple Mount area is strictly forbidden due to the holiness of the site. So while this sign has been there for years, if you've read anything about in recent days, there have been some conservative religious Jews that have gone up to the Temple Mount site in deference to the Muslims that are on the site, not wanting them there, and they've held prayer services up there, which is illegal. Some of them are actually in political hot water right now. They were politicians as well as conservative Jews, and they've gone up to the Temple Mount to try and stir up problems. So anyway, we'll take you up to the very top of the Temple Mount, And if this is the Temple Mount area, I just want to show you something so that you get an idea of where I am. You walk up the Temple Mount right in here. This is the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. So what Emily and I are going to do is we're going to go all the way down to this corner, and then we're going to walk the periphery and come back to the Dome of the Rock. So the first video that you see is from this back corner here, because it's flat and you can take a sweeping video of the whole thing. So let's get up on top of the Temple Mount. The walls that you see, the first wall that you see on the left would have been the eastern wall of the ancient temple that would have been around at the time of Herod the Great. A lot of these stones would have been thrown down by the Romans and then rebuilt, but it's still that same wall. All right, so here we are at this this corner. Now, one of the things about this corner that this is speculation on my part. I want to mean speculation. You remember one of the places that Satan took Jesus says it took him up to the high point of the temple and said, if you're the Son of God, cast yourself down. That would have been this corner right here, because the biggest drop is at this corner. It goes down into the Kidron Valley, and that is not a place you want to drop off of. So this is probably that spot where Satan would have taken Christ up to and said, if you're the Son of God, throw yourself down. That would have happened right here. All right, so here we go. That's the southern wall of the Temple Mount complex. That's the Al-Aqsa Mosque. A lot of trees up there. Marlis even mentioned she didn't realize so much of the trees. There's the Dome of the Rock. There's some stairs that lead down to the bottom. And then we're going to walk along this eastern wall and go all the way down. And then, again, we have hundreds of pictures from up here, but I'm not going to show any of those. We walked all the way around and then back up to the Dome of the Rock. So here's the Dome of the Rock. They call it the Rock because there is a stone that's on the inside. That stone has been carved and cut and hewed and damaged over the years. But if you remember the story of Ornan the Jebusite, that was below this rock was the threshing floor. And this is where David bought and said, this is where the Holy of Holies is going to be, on the rock. This rock is also the place where, according to Muslim tradition, Muhammad was on his horse, and God called him up to heaven to receive the Quran. So they see this as a holy site. The Jews see it as a holy site. The Christians see it as a holy site because they think that there has to be a third temple before the Messiah can return. And so everybody wants this piece of property. This is the second or third time I was here, I almost got booted out because I tried to get into the Dome of the Rock. I bribed the guard a $20 bill to go in, and I almost got in. I had to take my shoes off, put them in a little cubbyhole. But as I was going in, this lady came out who looked to me like she was 85 years old. And I don't know what she said, but I don't think I'd want to know what she said. Anyway, I retrieved my $20 bills and left. So, this is the Dome of the Rock. This is over that area. Again, if I ever show the video or do the presentation on where was the ancient temple, there is a reason why we have good belief that the rock that is inside this structure was where the Holy of Holies used to be. Just to give you an idea of the mosaics here, this whole thing is absolutely gorgeous. Up at the very top, it's hard to read because Arabic writing is hard to read, but those are scriptures from the Quran. In case you can't see it, all that right there is writing in Arabic. These are individual tiles that are set up there. By the way, the gold on the top is recent. That was only done 15 or 20 years ago. Originally, the dome was black, and then sometime in the late 50s, it was gilded with gold. But then over years, it got kind of dull again, and so they regilded it just not too many years ago, 20, 25 years ago. But here's a picture from, this is from the Temple Mount, and I want to show this to you. This is from the Temple Mount. This is the Kidron Valley down below, and this is the Garden of Gethsemane. So this is the area where Jesus Christ was praying with his disciples that final night, and where he was betrayed by Judas with a kiss. This is where Peter cut off the ear of one of the guards. And typical of the way Christianity does things. Someone came along here and says, well, if this is the Garden of Gethsemane, I've got to build this massive church right next to it, which probably obliterated a lot of what the natural garden would have been like. This is an Italian designer that put this together. And he tried to make this an interfaith thing. So there's Hebrew things, there's Arabic things, there's Christian things, there's, you know, kind of an all-faith hodgepodge. It's very ugly. But anyway, I wanted to show you this. And then here's one of the trees from the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, the tree, it is circumference-wise, if I were to go all the way around it, could be 25 or 30 feet. I mean, width-wide, this is probably an 8-foot-wide trunk of a tree. And I probably am doing my math wrong. Somebody do the circumference of a circle if the diameter is 8 feet. It's probably more than that. But anyway, it is hard to date olive trees because olive trees don't show rings like regular trees do. And the inside of olive trees get pithy and get eaten out by weather. So if you were to go up to this tree, you often will see bird nests and stuff that are built in the middle of it because it's hollow in the middle and it's just growing around. But the monks that work in this church, their job is to keep the Garden of Gethsemane going. And again, they know from tradition that these trees, although they're hard to date, they're big enough and old enough that they would have been around during the time of Christ. And very likely, I see no reason to doubt it, is the place where the Garden of Gethsemane was. All right, now what I want to do is I want to kind of draw this a little bit toward a close. You'll see what I mean in a moment. I wanted to talk about some things that are going on today, some of the digs that are going on, some of the new things that they're finding. But before I get there, I wanted to just show you just a little bit about what was happening at the Western Wall itself. So this is the western part of the, again, if this is north and the Dome of the Rock is right here, the Western Wall is this area right here, and it's the closest that Jews can get to the Holy of Holies without going up on the Temple Mount. So this is the place where they all come to pray. I wanted to show you this because it's really interesting. Due to the fact that this is a place where the Jews see as sacred, if you go, like right now, there's a live camera that will show you. I go to it every morning. I look to see how many people are there, and there's usually 15, 20, 30 people. But as the Sabbath starts to approach on Friday night, and I've been there 5 times. This is the first time I was ever there over the Sabbath. Emily and I started walking down there because what we were hoping to hear was as the Sabbath comes, you often will hear people out on balconies blowing the shofar. And that was what we were hoping for to get a video of. We were being passed by young adults. And by young adults, I mean 16 to 25, by the thousands. And they were in three-piece suit, shiny shoes, tie with their kippahs on, or if they were a little more orthodox, the larger hats, and they were headed to the Western Wall to welcome in the Sabbath. And the young adults were on the outside, and they were in a circle, and they were singing. You know, they were locking hands, and they were singing songs about the Sabbath. And then as it got right at sundown, then they all piled in, and this picture kind of shows, they all piled in, these are young and old alike, into the Western Wall, and they started singing. And I did a video of it. I was not supposed to take a video on the Sabbath. Taking a video is like lighting a fire because the click is an electronic something, and so it's not allowed. But I snuck a video against the law. But I wanted you to see how they treat the Sabbath because I just found this to be amazing. Now, I got several videos. I'm just going to show you one. These are of the young adults, and you're going to see them up front in this area. So the young kids are right there, and they're singing. It looks like a mosh pit, and it sounds like a mosh pit, but they're singing songs about the Sabbath. And then a little later on, a lot of the older people that are back here, they're linking arms, and they're singing songs about the Sabbath. I have one I wish I could play, but for the sake of time, I won't. But Hebrew songs welcoming in the Sabbath are absolutely gorgeous. So here's the kids as they're getting ready to honor the coming of the Sabbath.
Amen.
So I am right on. So there's a division between the men's section and the women's section because they pray separately. They're not allowed to pray together. There's an area around the Western Wall that they're trying to open up. That they call it an egalitarian prayer site where men and women can pray together. But that's going through. That is such a political football. It's actually in the courts right now to decide whether it's legal. But I'm against the wall. So I'm on the men's side. Emily is against the wall on the women's side. So we're standing right next to each other, but we're on opposite sides. She's standing up on a chair with her camera, and she actually took several videos, too, until she got yelled at by an attendant. The women, by the way, on their side do the same thing. They will get in circles. They're a little more calm than this mosh pit-like thing that you see, but they still get in a circle, and they hold hands, and they sing songs, and they welcome in the Sabbath. And, the love and the respect that they have when they're down there. I mean, they are dressed like they're coming before God. They dress better than I am dressed right now. This is a serious thing with them. And it was really nice to see. I would have to imagine that once these people are called and they recognize the truth, their love for God and for the Sabbath will be magnified. So just an amazing thing. All right, now what I want to do is we start to head toward the end. I want to show you just a little bit around the outside. And I asked Emily to go stand by these rocks so that you could see the magnitude of the destruction. So reading this, it says, collapsed on the paved streets are stones of the western wall of the Temple Mount enclosure. They were hurled down by the soldiers of the Roman legion after the destruction of the temple on the ninth day of the month of Av in 70 CE. This is when Jerusalem was destroyed. This was all covered in dirt, 25, 30 feet of dirt, and this was excavated. So they took this all the way down, and this street that you see right here, that is the street level that Jesus Christ and the disciples would have walked on. That's the actual street. I'm going to show you a video where I'm going to sweep across this, and you're going to see a lot of the stones that they threw were so big, as is evidenced by how small Emily looks compared to these stones. And Emily's as tall as I am, close. With her heels on, she's taller. That's another discussion. But what they did is they removed a lot of these stones to show the first century. But then they got to the place where they said, you know, we should leave some of these in situ so that people that come by here can see the level of the destruction of what the Romans did to this area. How hard would it have been to hurl some of these rocks off the Temple Mount? And you're going to see the damage that it did to a solid stone street when I show this next video. Also in this video, you will see rocks that are built up against the wall. These would have been shops where you read in the Bible where there were merchants that sold turtle doves and all of that for people to go up on the Temple Mount and do their worship. So you're going to see some evidence from these shops. You're going to see the damage to the street, and then it'll end kind of where Emily is. See the damage to the street there? These are the shops. And this is the ancient street that Christ would have walked on. And then those are the stones. There's Emily. Those are the stones that they left in place. And just to give you an idea of how badly that area was tormented. But now here's the really cool thing. And this has been ongoing for quite a while, but they're making more and more ideas behind it. So let me give you the background. Elliot Mazar, who's the granddaughter of Benjamin Mazar, dug in an area that was supposed to be the city of David. So you've got the Temple Mount, and then you've got kind of a slight little valley area, and then you've got this kind of mound, and all of the archaeological evidence and all of the writings from Josephus said this was supposed to be the city of David. So in, it was 2003 something, 2005, she started to dig. And dug down, 10, 12 feet, and didn't find anything, and she kind of scratched her head and thought, something's not right here. But they stopped for several years. Eventually, and I'm glad that she did, she came back and said, we just must not have gone deep enough. So she started to dig again. Now, what they were expecting to find were houses. Remember the houses by Capernaum, where you've got, maybe a 10-foot by 10-foot square. That's what they were expecting to find. And instead, what they found was what they're now calling the large stone structure. This would have been a massive building, the size or bigger than the temple. And this building didn't belong here. So now they're looking at it. They're kind of scratching their heads again saying, what is this? Then they started to find things around it that started to identify what this was. So let me read a little bit about this. Again, you see on here, Elliot Mazar revealed the remains of a large building known as the Large Stone Structure. Finds uncovered in relation to the structure indicate that this was built in the 10th century BCE. I'll show you why they put dates there in just a bit. During the reign of King David. In Mazar's opinion, this building can be identified as David's royal palace. Remember, he went to Hiram and asked for cedar, and he built a palace. And then he said, I live in a house of cedar, and God dwells in a tent. This is probably that building. Some of the things that they found there were remnants of stones, coins, etc., that would have been from the time of David, to where they recognized the fact that if this isn't the house of David, it was the Knesset or the Senate. But likely this was the house of David. Now, they went further, and they started to dig, and they went a little further down. For those of you that have been in Israel, you may remember seeing this if you went on one of the tours. So the large stone structure is up here, and you walk down, and this is a hill that goes down, and all along this hill down here are houses. This is a house that is built in the side of the wall, and it's right next to what is probably the palace of David. So these would have been some very influential people that would have lived there. Now, what happened is we know that David died and Solomon took over, and then Rehoboam tried to raise the taxes and split the country, and it went all the way down through to the time when Jeremiah was saying the Babylonians are going to come and they're going to kick your tail and you're going to go into captivity. And if you'll remember the story, it says that several of the officials during that time got so mad at Jeremiah that they grabbed him and they threw him in prison. Remember, they put him in a pit, and he sunk down to his armpits in the muck and the mire in the cistern. One of the guys that put Jeremiah in prison was named Gedaliah. So in this area, what they found was, you remember, if you've ever seen even things from ancient England or whatever, the king would have a signet ring, and they would take wax and melt it, and then they would press it in there. Well, they didn't have wax back in these days. They used clay. When the Babylonians came and raised it to the ground and burnt it, the clay, instead of melting away, turned to rock. So a lot of these, they call them bullas, or bullae, B-U-L-L-A, or B-U-L-L-A-E for plural, still exist as rock. And they found them in and around this house. Now, this house is interesting. It's got a kitchen. It's got bedrooms. It has indoor plumbing. If you think about it, I mean, you think of the early United States where, we had outhouses instead of indoor plumbing. They had indoor plumbing back here. Now, I imagine it just probably fell into a cistern, so I don't want to get any more graphic than that, but at least it was indoors. This was an area that would have been from a highly influential person. Here's some of the things that they found while they were there. Look on the left, Jeremiah 38, verse 1. Shephatiah, the son of Matan, Gedaliah, the son of Pashur, Jukal, the son of Shelemiah, and Pashur, the son of and I'll go on with the rest of those names. Words that Jeremiah had spoken, and if you go on and read chapter 38, this is where Jeremiah gets in trouble. But they have found Bulla there. So this is an example of one on the right. This literally says in Hebrew, Gedaliah, the son of Pashur, which is exactly what Jeremiah 38, verse 1 says. He was a government official, and they have found 20 or 30 of these. They even found some that were still intact on the document. If the document was paper, it was destroyed. But if the document was a copper scroll, they still have it. So they have some scrolls that actually have his seal on it. You'll see one in the next picture. So they have found seals in this house from Gedaliah, the son of Pashur. And I want you to notice the second name in Jeremiah 38:1. It says Gedaliah, the son of Pashur, and it says Jukal, the son of Shelemiah. So they also found, and you can see an example of this, is a copper scroll. And all of these seals say the minister Jukal made his mark. That's literally what is said on that seal. So what we know here from this is that by the time that Judah was about to be conquered and taken into Babylonian captivity, some of the men that are listed as officials in the government at the time were officed or lived, one of the two, in this house that was right at the bottom of what would have been considered the king's palace. They also found evidence of burnt wood that was petrified because of the burning process that was still there, that was also dated. The wood would have been dated from the time of David, but the fire would have been from the time of Jeremiah. All right, now I want to tickle your imagination just a moment. I want you to look at this picture. We're right toward the end. We've just got a few minutes left. I know I've already been an hour. What do you see in this picture? I'm going to let you look at it for a minute. This is, by the way, the Eastern Wall. I should tell a story while you're thinking about that. So you see all these graves? You probably heard this story before, but the Muslims read in the Bible where it said that the Messiah would come through the eastern gates of the Temple Mount and take over. Well, they didn't want the Messiah coming to take over, so what they did was they blocked the eastern gates off, and if you see the eastern gates, they've bricked them up. But it also says that an observant Jew is not to be around a dead body. So to be doubly sure that the Messiah could never come through the east gates, they put a cemetery in front of the eastern gate. So you see this kind of amazing plethora of Muslim graves, thinking that that's going to keep a physical Messiah, a physical Jew, away from coming to the Temple Mount. But anyway, what do you see on that wall? You have to use your imagination even when you understand this, and it also helps if you read Hebrew, which most of us don't. But you see the grassy stuff that's growing out of the wall? I'm going to put four Hebrew letters there. Yod, He, Vav, He. A yod is small, a vav is longer. So you can see a small one there and a longer one there. You can see the hay right here. And then just the start of this, but if you look at the kind of mossy stuff that's growing, you can see that it almost looks like this last. What is yod, he, vav, he? God's name. That's the tetragrammaton. That's the YHVH. This is the name of God that's growing in moss on the side of the eastern hill. This caused a huge stir in 2001 when this moss, this vegetation started to grow. Now, is there anything to it? I don't know. But what was interesting at the time was they got really excited about this because they thought this is God showing that his Messiah is about to return. And here we are 2 weeks or 2 years past and it's still not happened. But this still gets in the news every once in a while over there. They keep watching for that fourth letter, thinking, well, maybe that fourth letter's got to finish before he comes back. So all eyes are on that growth there. But I think it's interesting. You can actually see the first three letters pretty clearly. For someone that would speak Hebrew, I mean, if what were to grow on here were L-O-R and then the start of the word D, in English, it would just pop right out. Well, to Hebrew people looking at this, this is very easy for them to see. So hang on and we'll see. Yod, He, Vav, He. All right. I want to actually, let me back up because I don't want you reading this yet. I mentioned at the beginning of the story that Jesus Christ did not start his ministry in Jerusalem, but I also mentioned that it didn't end there. So where did the ministry of Jesus Christ end? It ended right here. Acts 1, starting in verse 9. When he had spoken these things, this is after his crucifixion, after his resurrection, he's still doing his ministry, he's still teaching his disciples. While they watched, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven, as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, who also said, Men of Galilee, again, all of the disciples were from the area of Galilee, why do you stand here gazing up into the heavens? This same Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will so come in like manner as you saw him go into heaven. And they returned to Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey. Jesus ended his ministry by leaving on the top of the Mount of Olives. So this is a picture from the Temple Mount looking up at the Mount of Olives. And you'll be able to see some of these a little later on. All of this real estate here are Hebrew and Jewish graves because they can read in the Old Testament that the Messiah is going to come to the Mount of Olives. And they think, well, if he's going to come back and we're all going to get resurrected, then we want to be the first ones there. That's prime real estate. And there still are some areas where you can do graves there, but you'll see some of them in a while. But this is where his ministry ends. So Emily and I are up on the Mount of Olives, and I'm going to show you this as a video, but I wanted to stop here to be able to show you a couple of things that maybe you haven't seen. Again, you've read about this, but maybe you haven't seen it. So this is the old city of David. The Temple Mount is over here, and we're up on top of the Mount of Olives. Right down here is a valley. That is the Valley of Hinnom. What's the Valley of Hinnom in the New Testament? Gehenna. So when you read about Gehenna, so here's the story behind that area. This was an area where the Canaanites used to sacrifice their children to the god Tophet. And so this was an area that had fire that was burning all the time. And then the Jews later on, when they took this over, were so disgusted by the sacrifice that they made it into a garbage dump. So when you come out of the gate that's closest to Gehenna, it's called the Dung Gate, because that was where people took their refuge, and they would take it down, and the garbage dump in Hinnom, in Gehenna, was always on fire. So that was, Jesus Christ used that as a metaphor for what it would be like for the incorrigibly wicked. They would be thrown into Gehenna. That would have made perfect sense to first century Christianity that could look out on it from a high mountain and see that burning mass of refuse, stinking and smelling horrible and always on fire. So that's the Valley of Hinnom. So again, here we're standing on the top of the Mount of Olives. This is the area where Jesus Christ will return to. It's very exciting to be walking around up there and wonder, you know, am I on the spot where Christ last stood before he was taken up? Or am I on the spot where he's going to come back down? We'll read more about that in a minute, but here's the video. Whoops. Let me go back again. Let me start the video. So that's the old city of David. That's the start of the Temple Mount. Down in the front here is the Kidron Valley. There's some of those graves. This is the Kidron Valley. And down in this area right here is, this is kind of the site of the church where Gethsemane was. You can't see the garden because it's on the other side of this. But this is the view from the Mount of Olives back toward the Temple Mount. The picture that I took earlier was taken right here when I was looking up this way. So that gives you an idea of where it is. Not that far, but it is uphill. The first two times I did it, Pat, did you and I walk up? You and I walked up there. I will never, ever do that again. When we went up this time, I took a taxi. And it was real interesting because it was on the Sabbath. I wanted to be up here on the Sabbath to be able to look down at the Temple Mount and wonder. So we got into a taxi, and guy picked us up right outside. And from where he picked us up to the Mount of Olives, maybe a half a mile. And it took him like 15 minutes to get there. He's whining all around. And in my mind, I'm thinking, am I being kidnapped? I mean, I didn't know what's... So I finally asked him, and he goes, oh, it's the Sabbath. He says, we're not allowed to drive in automobiles on the Sabbath. So I have to take you through Palestinian territory to be able to get up to the top of the Mount of Olives. That's why it took so long and was so expensive. It was pricey. Anyway, yeah, again, you can see some of the graves down there. So as we think about this, what will this area look like when Christ returns? Do you think the Dome of the Rock will still be there after the tribulation and the day of the Lord? I don't know what this is going to look like, but I can almost guarantee you it's not going to look like this. This area is going to be under contention. The king of the south is going to march into this area. The king of the north is going to come down and try and take over this area. I don't know what this is going to look like when Christ returns, but this is where he will return when he comes back. Let's finish with this slide from Zechariah chapter 14. In that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain will move toward the north and half toward the south. And thus the Lord my God will come and all of his saints with you. This is the area where we will come down. We will rise in the first resurrection to meet Jesus Christ in the clouds. And we will return and our feet will stand on the Mount of Olives at the return of Jesus Christ, and we will establish the millennium. My hope is that this is more than just a travelogue, and maybe you could see a little bit about the start and the end of Jesus' ministry, as well as get a little better idea of the landscape where many stories of the Bible took place. Our daughter took over 1,100 pictures and videos. I showed about 12. If you want to stalk her Facebook page, you can see a lot of them. If it ever comes to the place where you want to see more, we can do a Bible study some night and I can go through more pictures. Again, for those of you that may never get there, you may want to see them. But my interest, obviously, in this is one of these days, there are going to be a group of people stand on this mount at the start of the millennium, anxiously anticipating not only the return of Christ to his throne, but the establishment of 1,000 years of peace. I hope we're all there.